Empower yourself today with legal knowledge and follow us on Instagram, Twitter, or Facebook to get access to jargon-free legal information in plain and simple English. Today's episode is supported by Red Bar Law, the go-to law firm for expert, efficient, and fast legal assistance, all at a fixed cost. Go to our website at redbarlaw.com. Empower yourself today with legal knowledge and follow us on Instagram, Twitter, or Facebook to get access to jargon-free legal information in plain and simple English. Today's episode is supported by Red Bar Law, the go-to law firm for expert, efficient, and fast legal assistance, all at a fixed cost. Go to our website at redbarlaw.com. Our episodes are free to access. However, if you feel that you would like to support the children's charity that we are raising money for, then head over to our Just Giving page at justgiving.com and search for Hattie Savari, where we are raising money for orphaned children at SOS Children's Villages, one of the worthiest children's charities. Donate as little as £1 for a great cause. Thank you. Hello and welcome to our podcast at Get Legally Speaking. Our legal conversation today will be about how to apply for an injunction in family law. This is part two of this episode, so please do listen to our part one. I am joined by pupil barrister India Flanagan from Thomas More Chambers in London. India is a pupil barrister and she is currently developing a common law practice. She practices in a wide variety of areas, including in family and criminal law. Thank you very much for joining me today, India.
Pleasure. Thanks for having me, Hattie.
Always a pleasure to have you, India. And I'm really pleased that we're discussing this as a part two podcast because actually people, lots of us don't understand, you know, what do we mean by injunctions and family law. And I certainly find that when I'm speaking to clients and I mention a non-molestation order or an occupation order, you know, people don't have a clue about what they are, and rightly so, because it's not often you think, oh, I need to get that person to stay right away from me, or an occupation order, I need to get somebody who I'm living with out of the property, or in some way the property literally divided into areas and times. So let's talk about this, India. Let's talk about what a non-molestation order is. What is that?
Well, a non-molestation order, Hattie, is basically what you just indicated. It's an order which stops somebody who is inflicting domestic abuse to somebody else. So if I call that person the respondent, and the person who wants to stop the domestic abuse continuing, that person is called the applicant. So the applicant applies for an order to stop the other person from molesting, so i.e. really committing further harm or violence or harassment. And this order, this non-molestation order, will protect the applicant and or a relevant child. So if you have a child living in the same household, the order can also extend to protect them. And there's no fixed length to a non-molestation order, but normally the court makes it for about a year.
Yes, and I have to say, when we're relating it to family law, you know, when tensions, unfortunately, relationships break down and tensions become very, very strained quickly, I do find that they are a good tool to just keep people apart and give everybody that breathing space. And particularly for the person saying, look, I need protection from this other person. It could be that they're just verbally, you know, harassing you or making you, you know, really upsetting you and doing things they shouldn't be doing. I find that in family law, these orders have been really crucial, and the courts have been really, really clever in the way they apply them, because they will say, for example, because obviously the person that the order's being made against says, well, I haven't done those things, or perhaps it's not as bad as that. And, you know, the word injunction is quite a serious word, isn't it? You feel like, oh my God, you don't get a criminal record by having an non-molestation order made against you. So I think that's an important factor. But I find that these orders in family law are really, really key, and they work really well. The judge may say, look, we'll put it in place for 6 months and then we'll come back and review it, or 12 months. So then the parties really do have an opportunity to stay apart, but for the tensions to calm down. Most importantly, for the person saying, look, I don't want this behaviour to continue, and to stop, that stops. from the moment the order's obtained. Now, we are going to talk about what an occupation order as well is as well before we go on to other aspects of non-molestation. So let's explain to our listeners what an occupation order is.
Well, an occupation order is similar in that it's an order that stops, again, somebody from doing something. But this order relates to a property normally. So it's sometimes referred to as ouster orders, and it creates rules as to who can live in a house, which parts they can occupy, how they must behave, whether they must leave the property, whether they cannot return within a certain distance or a street of the property. And there are two types. One type of occupation order declares or extends or creates rights for the property, and one regulates the occupation of who can live in the family home. And for both orders, Hattie, I think it's important to stress that you have to be eligible to apply. So in order to apply for an order against somebody else, you must be an associated person, which means you've got to have kind of close relationship with that person. So for example, if you're married or you have a child together, or your close family relative and parents,
sisters, you've got to be living together, haven't you, India? I mean, because the whole point of the whole point, and again, I find very, very useful. And usually when somebody's applying for a non-molestation order, the occupation order will usually be something that will be attached to it as an additional application that's
exactly
being made. Because what we're saying here is, look, tensions are high, people are getting upset, the applicant's getting upset or being harmed or being abused. I mean, it comes in various forms. As I said, it doesn't have to be somebody physically, you know, hitting you or anything like that. It could be, it's, I have seen more emotional and verbal abuse than I have seen physical abuse in the work that I, you know, that we do.
Yes, and I think it's really important to emphasise that, as you do, that it's not just physical abuse. I mean, that's why domestic violence has been changed to domestic abuse, to recognise that lots of the forms of domestic abuse is emotional, psychological, coercive and manipulative behaviour.
Yes.
And orders are paramount to protect individuals from that type of behaviour.
Absolutely. And what I was saying is that the reason why they non-molestation orders and occupation orders usually come hand in hand, because if you're saying I need to get this person away from me, and you do live in the same property, and the other person does not have the means, the financial means or ability to go and rent a place or go and stay somewhere else, you've got this non-molestation order saying they can't speak to you directly or indirectly, they can't message you, they can't come anywhere near you. But then if that person doesn't have anywhere to go to live, the court will say, okay, well, I can't get them out of the property because they're making a case and showing to me they can't, they've got nowhere to go. So what I will do is I'll say during 9 and 10 a.m., you use the kitchen, you know, for example, if there's one kitchen, won't they? And then, or, you know, you have locks on your bedroom's doors, you are not to enter into each other's doors. And I think that also works as well. I'll never forget years and years ago, the first occupation order that I did was that actually where the judge split the property and times of usage of the property up. And I remember sitting in the back of the courtroom while, you know, counsel was representing our client and thinking, that's just not going to work. How is that going to work? Where two people who actually are at a really bad place, tensions are high. We've just got the non-molestation order where the judge has said, yes, I will grant that. So now let's talk about an occupation order. How's it going to work if somebody has to go to the bathroom at 9 o'clock and the other one can only go there at 10 o'clock? And then, you know, these times, but the judge got it right. And I have to say, we had it in place for a number of months. And when we came back to revisit it, what I was really astonished to see that the parties had kept to that, particularly the person that the order was made against. And it worked. It does. Yeah. Work, you know, I'm yet to see somebody, and we've done a lot of these occupation orders and non-molestation orders, I'm yet to see somebody breach that, because that's what we're going to talk about next.
Yeah, no, exactly. And dividing orders, dividing up the house, white line orders can be very effective. So it's very important to recognise that as a viable option for sure.
Absolutely. And let's talk about the consequences. So if someone's saying, okay, well, I'm in this situation where I need this person to be stay away from me and not be able to continue with the abuse or the harm or the hurt or whatever it is. What happens if that person breaches it? Say if they don't listen and they go against what a court has ordered and told them to do, which is not to contact me or not to come near me or to use the house in a certain way if that person has not been removed from the house. And let's just make something clear here. If the court feels there is a serious, serious position of harm on the applicant, even if the respondent hasn't got anywhere to go, they will get them out of the house.
Yes.
They're not going to say, we accept that there's serious harm here, and because you're saying you've got nowhere to go, Mr. or Mrs. Respondent, you can stay in the house. The judge will order that. I mean, I think that needs to be made clear.
Yes, no, that's very important. And even if the applicant's worried about applying for an occupation order because, for example, they individually are not entitled to occupy the house, but the respondent is, an occupation order can still be made. There's just various sections that the orders can be made under. So it's yes. important to stress that as yes. well.
So what are the consequences of breaching an order that's been made? And we're talking about the person that it's been made against. Let's tell our listeners about that, please, India.
Well, for a non-molestation order, I think it's very important to assure any applicant who has this order of the protection that a non-molestation order can create, because a breach of a non-mol is a criminal offence. So that means that an individual who has breached that order can be charged and prosecuted in the criminal courts, i.e. the magistrates or the Crown Courts. And the maximum sentence for a non-mol, a breach of a non-mol, is 5 years. The family court has the power to punish, but it's rarely used. And it's normally goes down the criminal avenue for a breach of a non-molestation order. A breach of an occupation order is slightly different in that it's not a criminal offence, but the family courts can deal with a breach of an occupation order. They can punish a respondent for a breach up to a maximum of 2 years, but that would be for a contempt of court. In other words, you didn't follow a court order that we've imposed, and therefore we're going to give you a sentence accordingly. And an occupation order as well as a non-molestation order, they both carry a power of arrest. So if an applicant calls the police and says this person has breached the order, the police can go and arrest them, and that's very important.
Yes, I think that's because they never used to come with an arrest order attached to them, and I think the courts just said, look, it just makes sense to do that, because then it makes the order a lot more serious than, well, if you don't listen, you come back to court, because damage could be done if somebody has breached an order and then, you know, nothing's been done by the authorities, by the police, by it. And you have, by the time you get back to court to sort it out, it could be a very serious situation. So they do come with an arrest order attached. And I think that's really powerful, because at the time that the order is made, the person that it's been made against, you know, if you know you'll get a criminal record, that's a very serious thing, you know, in life. If you breach it, then they are taken much, much more seriously. And what I want to just mention here, because I think it's important as well, India, is that when the order is made, it should be served upon the respondent. The person that it's been made against should have it served upon them by what's called a process server, because then it's formally served on that person. They can't say they didn't receive it. They can't say they didn't know about it. Process server produces a statement to say, this has now been formally served on you. If the first hearing was made ex parte without the respondent knowing about it, and then they went back to court, if they didn't come back to the court hearing when they were on notice to come and say, look, here's my side of the story, and this is why this order shouldn't be made, or however it is, then have the order served upon the respondent, because then there's no doubt. And what the process server will do is also explain the details of the order. So if the respondent didn't turn up for the return hearing so that they could tell their side of the story, then have that order, and the order's been made, have an order for a non-molestation order or an occupation order served upon the respondent, so that the process server can really say, look, chum, this is the situation. Don't breach this. This order's been made by a court because you'll be in serious trouble.
Exactly. A breach of a non-molestation order is an offence if the respondent doesn't have a reasonable excuse. And obviously it will depend on the circumstances, but it's a matter of fact that if it's clear the respondent has just breached it and has absolutely no justification for doing so, the court will take that very seriously.
I think the other situation, India, that I found that also has happened in these hearings is where we've made the application for, say, a non-molestation order, and the other side will say, well, hold on a moment, I'm being agitated by the applicant, by the person saying they need protection from me. They're actually doing things to me as well. So what we have found, which is not uncommon, is that both sides get a non-molestation order, because there is a situation here which maybe, you know, people don't consider naturally. And that is, if you've got the order, so you've got the protection, then what protection does the person you've got the order against have against you agitating them or pushing them to breach the order? And I think that's really important. So I have seen it where both sides get an order for non-molestation, because then it means there's no argument that person egged you on, spurred you on, made you behave in the way you did, pushed you to breach your order, because you're both under the same restrictions. And sometimes the court may say, well, look, we don't need non-molestation orders, because I think there is an issue here which both parties are now willing to take seriously. Let's give what's called cross undertakings.
Exactly.
And they're very good as well, aren't they, India?
Yes, exactly. Just as you've just outlined, Hattie, cross undertakings can be very effective for both parties, because they're what in a sense it means is both parties are giving a solemn promise to the court, saying that they won't continue with their specific behaviour towards each other. And then those undertakings, those promises, will be formally recorded. And normally, if you have a cross undertaking, hopefully they'll be accepted by the other party, so it's clear where both parties stand.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think that's sort of a step down, but again, it helps to diffuse situations which are really highly charged, where people are upset. You know, and I have to say, I've sat there and people have said, well, I'm not giving an undertaking. And my first thing would be, well, if you're not doing anything wrong, you shouldn't have a problem with giving an undertaking.
Exactly.
You know, I've seen it many times. People sit there and think, oh, okay, well, that's a strong argument, because it's true. If you say, I'm not giving an undertaking, I'm not doing anything wrong, why should I give an undertaking? And it's very simple. If you're not doing anything wrong, then give the undertaking, because you won't be breaching it, will you?
No. Exactly. And it also offers, although it's not a criminal offence if you breach it, the family court can punish it again as a contempt of court. So it can give the other party, if they, for example, haven't made the undertaking, that little bit of protection and assurance that the court will treat it properly.
Yeah.
If there is such a breach.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Okay. So we have got time to discuss something next, very quickly, and that's about domestic violence protection notice. What is a domestic violence protection notice? Let's explain that, please, India.
Yes, no, I think it's very important to emphasise that there's this other kind of option, because we always talk about non-molestation orders and an occupation order, but domestic violence protection notices, sometimes called GO orders, they really commenced nationally in 2014, and they're basically mini non-moles and occupation orders, and they're handed out by the police rather than by courts, and they're used for emergencies. And these notices stop the alleged perpetrator of the domestic abuse from contacting the alleged victim, returning to the home for initially 48 hours, and the notice can obviously be served, and then the court can extend this notice to 14 or 28 days by making a domestic violence protection order. So both the notice and the order are intended to offer immediate short-term protection and allow the victim to decide how to proceed in order to obtain a more practicable longer-term solution. And breach of this isn't punished like a contempt of court, but it is a facility to offer that immediate protection if required.
See, I think that's really, really interesting and key, actually, India, because what we haven't explained is, you know, if you want to get a non-molestation and an occupation order, what do you do? How do you go about it? Now, these are usually urgent orders. Now, something could happen on a Saturday or a Sunday or of an evening. By the time you get hold of a legal team to say, I need to make this application, because the police may say, if they've attended as a property or to, you know, as a scene, look, this is a civil matter. You know, you've really got to get hold of a solicitor or a barrister via direct access and speak to a law firm, you know, quickly. The police can still, what we're saying, is issue this domestic violence protection notice for the next 48 hours, which hopefully would be enough time for you to get hold of a lawyer to say, I need something in place to protect me further than what's been issued by the police. So I think that's really key, because if the police turn up and you have a situation which has just gone from bad to worse and you need to feel that you're protected from the other person, you can insist to the police that you want them to issue something to give you some form of protection until you can get on the phone to a lawyer to help you out. So I think that's a key bit of information there, because naturally, if the police, and I had it with a client where a client's called me late in the afternoon and said, actually evening, 8 o'clock, and said, I've just had to call the police. The matters, you know, this stuff, something at home has just got out of hand. It's gone too far. And I could sort of see the pot was boiling and bubbling, ready to spill over. And it happened that evening. And the police were telling her there was nothing they can do. It was a civil matter, even though there was a domestic abuse, and that she just had to contact her lawyers the next day. And I said to her, just wait there. She actually didn't live too far from where I was. So I said, just tell the police to hold on. And I went down and I got there and I had a chat with the police, and they did issue a protection notice, but only after I'd spoken to them. So they were happy to leave that evening without putting anything in place to protect, you know, my clients until we could make an application, even though it be an urgent application, to the court. So I think that's very helpful.
Yes, exactly. It's time pressure of a domestic violence protection notice is very important, because the court then must hear an application for a domestic violence protection order within that 48 hours of the notice being served. So there is that urgency, therefore, that follows after the notice. So yes, it is very effective.
Indeed. Well, India, another great podcast. Thank you ever so much for your time. I know you're in court today, so I wish you all the very best of luck with that.
Thank you very much.
And what I'll say to our listeners is, don't forget to click and subscribe to our podcasts. And you can find us on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, YouTube and LinkedIn by searching Get Legally Speaking. Also visit our website at getlegallyspeaking.com.
Empower yourself today with legal knowledge and follow us on Instagram, Twitter or Facebook to get access to jargon-free legal information in plain and simple English. Today's episode is supported by Red Bar Law, the go-to law firm for expert, efficient and fast legal assistance, all at a fixed cost. Go to our website at redbarlaw.com. Our episodes are free to access. However, if you feel that you would like to support the children's charity that we are raising money for, then head over to our Just Giving page at justgiving.com and search for Hattie Savari, where we are raising money for orphaned children at SOS Children's Villages, one of the worthiest children's charities. Donate as little as £1 for a great cause. Thank you. Empower yourself today with legal knowledge and follow us on Instagram, Twitter or Facebook to get access to jargon-free legal information in plain and simple English. Today's episode is supported by Red Bar Law, the go-to law firm for expert, efficient and fast legal assistance, all at a fixed cost. Go to our website at redbarlaw.com.